sharply off the rocks. The drizzle became a shower, and then the shower became a deluge. There was no cover for the companions. They shielded their heads with their arms, crouching as they were pelted by the hail of little corpses. The full downpour lasted only a few seconds. When it was over, thousands of unmoving bodies darkened the ground, and the air was thick with tiny, shredded bits of feather. The fluff made Mildred sneeze. She warned the others.
Better not touch them. It's possible they could be carrying some kind of pathogen, a virus that might be contagious.
Undaunted, Christy picked up one of the broken creatures.
Must have died triple quick. It's still warm.
She gently turned the bird in her hand.
No sign of any disease. Looks like they were all struck stone dead.
Overhead, the sky was blue, and the blue was endless.
Where the blazes did they come from?
Mildred shuddered as she brushed the feathers from her face and plaits. Doc observed her discomfort.
A person given to superstition might well consider it a sign from Yahweh himself. Similar to a rain of live toads or lamb's hearts, an omen of unspeakable evil.
Clearly disturbed by the unusual event, Mildred immediately snapped back.
Is that the kind of unscientific crap the deans taught you at Oxford, Doc? Did you get your doctorate in Victorian nonsense?
I'm afraid the idea of strange rains goes back a bit further than that, my dear.
The question is, what chilled them?
JB used the toe of his boot to spread out a small heap of bodies.
Ahead, big danger.
Jack turned to Ryan.
Feel rumbling feet.
When they were quiet, they could all feel the faint but unmistakable shaking of the earth.
Shall we proceed on the current course, my dear Ryan? Or is an alternate route in order?
Don't know what the rumble means. Could be anything.
Sure as hell is an Amtrak.
Until we find out what's going on, let's take it nice and slow. Everybody up now.
On triple red, they continued following the ridgeline, which began to bend gradually northward. Long before they caught sight of them, they felt the hot wind off the string of lakes. Felt, smelled, tasted. This brimstone was the real thing, giving off a rotten egg stink that gagged and choked them. The closer they got to the source, the louder the rumbling noise became. As the companions crested the top of a low rise, they were slammed by a wall of baking heat that forced them to shield their faces with their hands. Below, in a sunken area of the plain, acres upon acres of desert boiled and steamed. The mud-brown lakes were bodies of superheated liquid, erupting from deep in the earth along nuke blast-opened fault lines. Whole trees uprooted, their upraised branches stripped of leaves and bark and mineralized to a dead white, swirled like drowning men in the violent whirlpools. For hundreds of yards around the lake shores, there was nothing but peaked piles of sulfur crystals and orange patches of bacteria. Bacteria were the only living things that could survive the combination of high temperature and toxic gases. In the center of the closest lake, the water's surface suddenly bulged up, then burst with a dull explosion that sent mud flying like shrapnel and a huge cloud of steam skyward. They all ducked and covered. Ryan waited until things had settled down to speak.
There's your answer, Mildred. Bubble of hot poison gas goes up. Way high out of sight, the flock of birds flies right through it. Bang, no more birds.
Dead in midair.
Dead there, too.
Dean pointed at the ground 10 yards ahead. It wasn't just birds who got done in by the mud lake gases. Land creatures wandering a little bit closer to the shoreline had been felled by similar sideways discharges. Dismantled skeletons of animals, large and small, lay scattered about. The bleached bones were scored with fang marks. Something big had been cleaning up after the dead. This bad place.
We go around, it's going to add 5, maybe 6 miles to the hike. Might be after dark by the time we make Moonboy.
The truth of the armorer's words was obvious. If they circled the boiling lakes on the plains side, it would take them south, away from their goal instead of toward it.
I figure we've already covered the distance the barman talked about. Looks to me like there's a climbable gully over there. Let's follow it to the ridge summit and have ourselves a look-see on the other side.
Even though the gully was passable, the climbing wasn't easy. The gully bottom was lined with heaps of loose, gravel-like rock that had flaked off and fallen from the cliffs above, and the terrain got gradually steeper and steeper until the last 30 feet, which was straight up. The backbone of the ridge was made of crumbling spires of rock, and the clusters of spires were divided from one another every few hundred yards by uncrossable chasms and deep clefts, which was why the companions hadn't tried to travel along it the whole distance from perdition. Following Ryan's lead, they carefully crept to the edge of the summit and looked over. The barman had been telling the truth, at least in part. There was no way to miss Moon Boy. Some freak of geologic erosion had created a wide protected nook in the promontory rock. Below them, the Ville lay nestled in a roughly circular box canyon. Even though the actual paving had long since disintegrated, at a distance of 1,000 yards, Ryan and the others could still make out the maze-like layout of the pre-dark development streets. They could also see the gridwork of its building lots, though 95% of the original dwellings had been reduced to rubble by the Trinuke, by the elements, and by legions of human scavengers. A few of the light poles stood upright, towering over the spreading shamble of huts and shacks. Because the backsides of some of the surviving three-story buildings faced them, most of Moon Boy's main street was blocked from their view.
"Stay low, and keep your weapons down. We don't want sun flashing off our gun barrels."
They watched in silence for a few minutes, passing their three pairs of binocs back and forth. Nothing moved below.
"A Ghostville."
"I don't see anything but recycled pre-dark wreckage down there."
"The scrounger might have made up the story about the muties with strange chilling gear just to cadge a few drinks."
"Yeah, but a Ville this size, this time of day, should have people walking around. There's no sign of life."
At his suggestion, JB moved out to scout another angle of view, and he came back quick.
"Better all have a look."
The companions followed JB around the far side of the ridge's spires, and from the new vantage point, got a view straight down the main drag. Something strange was going on there, all right. Something dark stuck up in the middle of the deserted street. They took turns looking at it through the rubber-armored binocs.
"A derrick, maybe. Plenty tall. On 8 wheels. Could be motor-driven."
"It's never seen a nuke attack or a drop of acid rain, either. Metal looks new."
"Way over to the right. Is that a war wag?"
Ryan accepted the binocs from Christie and framed the vehicle in its view field. Painted desert camo with oversized all-terrain tires, the squat wag had an enclosed two-man driver compartment, but there was no armored rear passenger area for troops.
"Not like any LAV I ever saw."
What was behind the vehicle was even more interesting to him. On a big-wheeled flatbed trailer, connected to the wag by a tow hook, sat a streamlined black machine on skids.
"Mildred, what do you make of the thing it's towing? Looks like a helicopter."
She studied the object.
"Yes, it looks to me like a one-person helicopter."
"Pre-dark flying machine designed for vertical takeoffs and landings."
"Right, only it's all black. There's no window for the pilot to see out of. And I've never seen a chopper with a rotor configuration like that. The tail rotor is 90 degrees offline and it's way too big, almost like a rear propeller. All those stubby things sticking out of the nose, that looks like a weapons cluster to me."
"Had to have been looted from a redoubt."
"But what's it doing here?"
Ryan lowered the binocs. It was a good question. The all-out nuclear exchange of 2001 had produced an electromagnetic pulse that had fried every computer chip and circuit board on the planet, save those buried deep in the fortified, radiation-shielded bunker complexes known as redoubts. Ryan knew that operational flying machines still existed in Deathlands. They'd seen them. But as far as he was concerned, travel by air was nothing more than a fable told by Dr. Mildred Wyeth. Assuming such a machine was found, and that it could be prepped and fueled, there was no safe way to learn how to fly it by trial and error. The only use it could serve was as an ornament in some baron's garden. Armageddon had turned humankind back into a species of flatlanders, of dirt crawlers. There was a flurry of movement below, as five figures in black stepped from the front of a pre-dark structure on the left. They spread out and began to work on the upraised derrick. In a few seconds, they had lowered it, soundlessly, to a horizontal position. For what purpose, Ryan couldn't guess. Christie was the first to speak.
"So the scrounger wasn't lying about them after all. Do you think he was telling the truth about Moon Boy's norms, too? That they've all been chilled?"
"Either that or they ran away."
Ryan knew the latter wasn't very likely.
"Sure don't look like muties to me. Look like norms in full battle armor. Remember that Hideyoshi and the other samurai warriors we come across a while back?
Yeah, but this gear is different. There's no horns on these helmets. The overlapping armor plates appear to be the same material as the helicopter, the same oil.